Hopheads. I'm Justin Crosley.
And I'm Nick Ziegler.
And this is the Hop and Brew School podcast. Once again, back in the studio and with us, I'm excited about this, once again, we've got Pat Jensen, the technical manager at Yakima Chief Hops. And also, I got it right this time, Tommy Yancone, the technical brewer.
How's it going?
Yeah.
How you guys doing?
He makes the good stuff.
I do like yank corn, though. That's a for when we get a cereal masher, dude.
How about I just change it every time Tommy's in the studio?
That sounds like a great idea.
No one will ever know who he really is.
Tommy Yancone, I don't care.
Yeah.
Nice.
I want Tommy's job, though. I think being the technical brewer at Yakima Chief Hops is a pretty cool gig, man.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. It's been great so far.
Yeah, you should be.
That's during selection, though, how many thousand or how many?
I think I got up to 1130.
1,130 lots of different hops coming in you to rub.
Okay. Oh, that's last, right.
Last
that's
couple days.
Had all the allergic reactions.
Oh, yeah.
So every dream job has its pitfalls.
Indeed.
Well, today on the Hop and Brew School podcast, we're going to be talking about hop combos. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And the point of this podcast and everything we do is to connect the world's finest brewers and homebrewers with more knowledge about hops so that we can all drink better beer. Keep that in mind. It's always our goal. So in the last couple of episodes, we discussed hop chemistry and getting to know some of the compounds that are found in hops. And today, we're going to use some of that knowledge to figure out how to put it into practice, right?
That's the idea. So we're basically going to go through, again, just to refresh your memory, what the, sort of the compound classes and some examples of those are the key drivers of aroma and flavor in hops. And then look at how they interact. And then later on, give you a bunch of hop combinations that might work. And so we're going to list up the hops that have those in high proportions, as well as just high raw volume, which is actually something to consider. So the difference between the proportion, so if you might have like, you know, 60% of your hop oil is myrcene, but if you've only got less than 1%, you're not going to get that much myrcene. Whereas okay. If you've got 3% oil, you know, you're going to get a lot more.
Got it. And some of this research is fairly new that we're sharing here.
Yeah, not even published yet, so.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I love that. See? You found it. Finally, the Brewing Network gets a scoop.
Yeah, eventually we're going to start sharing this stuff on a broader basis. But really, this is really pretty cutting edge stuff, and this is a combination of research that has been published as well as stuff that we're discovering about hop varieties. A lot of the stuff has been well established already in other fields. But we're trying to prove it out in hops and beer. And we're going to basically share it with you guys so you can play with it. With the caveat that we are absolutely extrapolating from what we know. And we, you know, we haven't proven absolutely everything out, but sure. Based on experience from brewers and our data in the lab and what we know about chemistry, this is what we think is working and going on.
Okay. And with all science, I mean, things do change from time to time based on what we know.
That is the beauty of it.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we get right into, I guess this is kind of a recap from the last episode, where we need to just recover the compound classes and what it is that they provide.
Right. Okay. So we're really only going to be focusing on three major ones, and the fractions of the oils, the oil fractions and stuff that we're really interested in for aromatic character in hops. Because, you know, when you're really driving a beer, that's usually what you're after. So we're going to be basically looking at terpenes and terpene alcohols, thiols, and esters.
Got it.
And so brewers are probably familiar with the last one, and they've heard about the first one. It's very common in the marijuana industry as well, in the cousin industry, because that's one of the ways you can actually phenotype varieties. You can actually scan. You can scan for those the terpene compounds and be able to say, okay, yeah, this is actually X variety, Y variety, or X brand, Y brand. Hashtag corporate Alex.
Right.
And so these things are really important drivers. And I think we mentioned this last time is that on their own, these compounds aren't necessarily the major contributors to the characteristic of a given variety or brand. They really all work in concert. And so that's where we're going to try to uncover that a little bit today.
Okay.
So, Pat, terpenes and terpene alcohols. Can you kind of refresh us on what they are, what they mean?
Well, the terpenes, the major ones are the myrcene, caryophyllene, humulene, which are the isoprene units combined together to make either terpenes, monoterpenes, or sesquiterpenes. And the terpene alcohols, our two favorites, are linalool and geraniol, with a couple of lesser known ones that make it in the final beer due to biotransformation or isomerization, and that's citronellol and neurol.
Mm-hmm. And so linalool has been described as the major character for citrusy.
Okay.
Geraniol has traditionally been described as flowery or floral. So linalool will be citrusy hop. Geraniol might be floral hop in any tasting kits you've done. Whereas citronellol, as you know, we talked about this before, like sort of citronella candles and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And neurol is, neroli. It's for the orange oil. And what's interesting is that you know, Pat, you know, we've talked about this at length, is that geraniol actually undergoes some changes throughout the beer. And we think that citronellol and neurol might actually derive from some of the other terpenes. Is that correct?
Yeah, generally, it's biotransformation of the geraniol. And the geraniol, during fermentation, can transform into citronellol and neurol. And even linalool at times.
Now, is it actually biotransformation? So is it enzymatic? Are the yeast taking in the geraniol and actually transforming it? Or is it more of a just sort of isomerization, like you said, due to the changing environment in fermentation?
That's probably debatable at this point. Hmm. People don't know enough at this juncture. But, I mean, I would lean probably just in the nature of the difference in the matrix of what happens during fermentation, that the pH drop, stuff like that, can cause these types of isomerizations. But you can't rule out the fact that you're in a yeast environment where they are making a difference in the beer. So they too could be playing a role in these isomerizations. Or actually, there's actually the cleavage of what they call the glycosides too, where you have enzymes that actually release some compounds from glycosidically bonded linalool, and it could possibly the geraniol too. But linalool is a little more known to be glycosidically bonded.
Yeah, there was some work done at Oregon State recently, and I think Kaylin Kirkpatrick did some work on that. And you can find her presentations and stuff on the CBC websites and the Brewers Association from the presentations they gave.
Okay.
And then also, what's interesting about that is that there's been a lot of attention paid to glycosides in sour beers, and this has been covered before in the Sour Hour, and I think on Brew Strong briefly as well, where the hypothesis is that there are glycosidic formations occurring in the boil and then throughout the process. So these aromatic compounds are binding onto sugars, and then they are being released by Brettanomyces and some of the other species in this co-fermented product to provide. Or I guess they get released, the Brettanomyces or the other organisms consume the sugars, and then the aromatics get released into the beer to be volatilizable again.
Okay.
Speaking with Jay last night, actually, at the Sour Hour podcast, it was interesting to talk to him about how what he's noticed is that a lot of his favorite characteristics in his beers, and Jay, forgive me if I'm misquoting you here, that there seems to be a high correlation between hopping rates and the hops that go into those boils and those beers and the development of complex flavors as they go on. And so he was saying to pay attention for the flower to flower that he did with the fresh hop beers,
because
I think that's going to be really interesting, and you know, I'm excited to see what happens.
So with these changes that take place and the different combinations, if I'm understanding this right, this is part of why we can't just rely on the data sheet and what it says the intensity of any of these oils are, because they alter at times and present something different in the final beer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's true that what you smell when you actually smell the actual raw hop, and when you rub it in your hands and you smell, that's not actually what you're going to get in your final beer.
Even with dry hopping.
Let's just make beer more difficult, shall we? That even the things that we smell might not be the things that we smell.
Absolutely. That's essentially what it is.
This is why I respect great brewers who have such consistency in across all of their styles. You know, when I was a musician, I used to say, like, everybody can write one good song. And I kind of feel that way about beer, too. Everyone can make one good beer. But to do it across all the styles really takes an understanding of these changes, in my opinion, to be able to guide your beer exactly to where you want it.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the purpose of this episode, is to sort of start to get people thinking about how to look at their ingredients and their process so that they can really start to build up either an experimental approach or a good base of knowledge on what they should be looking for.
Okay.
And so really experienced brewers, I mean, for example, Vinny, he makes very, very consistent and very wonderful beer. He knows, based on his experience of his process, what the beer is going to smell like given a certain amount of inputs. And that's just experience.
Right.
And so if we can sort of raise that platform for everybody, we're all going to get to drink better beer.
And and I'm going to say, because I know we're going to talk about it later, because Nick, you've really put this out in the podcast, and I think it's important. It's not just experience, but it's data collecting. And my guess would be that Vinny has a lot of data collection at Russian River on top of his experience.
Yeah, he alluded to this last night, where he was saying how the amount of data that he's collecting, and you know, he's a data hawk as well, which is wonderful. So another reason I respect him a bunch. But in terms of what you said earlier, like, we don't know what we're smelling. I mean, there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, there are unknown unknowns, and there are unknown knowns.
Okay.
And then when we know what we don't know, we really enter the realm of the unknown.
Okay.
So
I just that's going to be a Brewing Network t-shirt, I think. You just gave us our first quotable quote from the show.
Oh, no. Please don't let my first quotable quote be quoting Donald Rumsfeld.
That's very good. Okay, so that was a little summary of the terpenes and terpene alcohols.
Yeah, and there are way more than that. But at the moment, we're just looking at sort of a top-level stuff, the main drivers. So the next set of compounds, and we mentioned this last time, are the thiols. Okay, and thiols, again, are sulfur-containing compounds, and they, on their own, they're not always tremendously active. And also on their, well, I mean, some of the thioesters, for example, can be negative. They can give you like sort of cabbagey character, some onion garlic character, and all that stuff. And so they don't smell very good on their own necessarily. But when they enter into a complex matrix with some of the other compounds like the terpenes and other esters, you get some really interesting expressions. And it's interesting. I think I alluded to this early in the show, earlier in another episode, about how thiols typically indicate either ripening fruit, fermentation, or putrescence. And so those are three things that you have to pay attention to as a living organism. So the presence of thiols in an aromatic complex are going to make you pay attention to it, either in a negative way or a positive way. And so, I mean, some of the things that we've looked at, we mentioned this before, were 3-MH, which is, Pat, what's the... Oh, God, I'm calling you out, aren't you? Sorry.
Yeah, you told me I didn't have to write it down. You totally said that. Right?
I totally did say that. Okay, we'll go with the other one. So 4-MMP and 4-MSP, which are the ribes, blackcurrant, or frequently ascribed as caddy hop.
Can you tell me, if you can't tell me exactly what 3-MH is, that's okay, but what is it we're talking about when we say 3-MH or 3-MHA?
That would be 3-methyl...
Hexanol
is 3-MH, and those are that's a way of writing the molecule down of how you describe it.
So that's what I'm getting at. A molecular structure.
Yeah, it describes
3-MH.
Yeah, it describes the molecular structure of that thiol.
Okay, that's what I needed to know.
It's a short term.
Okay,
so we don't have to say it all the way out.
Understood. Okay, carry on, please.
Okay, so in that case, 3-MH is that's one that gives rhubarb and citrus. 4-MMP and 4-MSP, so that's a 4-methylsulfonyl penta something or other. I'm so professional here. Ribes.
4-methyl-2-pentanone.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Capto-methyl-pentanone.
There we go. So, yeah, there you go. This is why you're here, Pat, to make me look stupid. I mean, to correct me when I'm wrong. So ribes, if you guys, that's a very British term.
Yeah, what are ribes?
It's basically the smell of blackberry branches.
Okay.
Which is a little weird.
But nice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But also, in excessive amounts, it smells like tomcat urine.
Okay.
So think about this. So blackcurrant, mulberries, like they're the little fruits of the, we don't really eat them here in the States, but they're a fruit that, you know, starving peasants in Europe had to eat. Our forefathers had to eat.
Right.
They're good on their own, but if you get too much of a concentration of them, like when they're in bloom, they really smell kind of like cat pee. So in high quantities, they're unpleasant, but as a part of a complex, they're wonderful because they combine to add a little bit of bite or a little bit of a different note to fruit flavors. So like when you next time you get a chance to, and you bite into a fruit, like say for example a bite of mango, you're going to say, oh, mango-y, and that's like the fruity mango. But then if you stop and pay attention rather than scarfing it down, I ate like a brewer, so like most of my meals take me about 3 minutes and 30 seconds to consume,
yeah.
Including Thanksgiving, which is really bad for my stomach.
Yeah, it is.
But what you're going to notice, there's a lot more things going on there than just fruity. You're going to get, you know, sort of the generic mango fruit, but then you're probably going to note some sort of sour citric character.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're also going to get probably a little bit of black pepper and maybe a little bit of like this sort of alcohol burn character like you get from orange skins. And those are terpenes interacting with sulfur compounds or thiols interacting with esters to create this whole complex.
I see.
So that's what's really, really fun about that. But when you just combine the esters and the terpenes and the terpene alcohols, there was a nice study done fairly recently, and I think Stan Hieronymus referenced this in The Complex Case of Thiols, is an article you can get online. It's basically looking at how a citrusy or fruity score might only be 2 out of 5.
All right.
using just the terpenes and the esters, which are traditionally classed as the fruity things. But when you throw in some of these thiols, it just bumps it all up. And so than doubles the potency of that of those aromatics. So these are thiols are way to look at thiols are they're potentiators.
And so just to back up for a second so I can have my own kind of real world example. When I used to describe certain lots of Simcoe as very catty, it was something I was really sensitive to for a while. Now I've come to love Simcoe, by the way. But do you think that those that was a high level of 4 MMP, 4 MSP?
100%.
Okay.
Yep. That's a really big thing.
I've learned one thing today so far. I like it.
But you can also get other characters in there that with other thiols, some of the thioesters that are a bit more onion and garlicky, and those will potentiate the catty aromas.
Okay.
So it's a delicate balance.
Right.
And so we as hop providers and our growers as hop growers really try to provide the best situation to make sure that we get the right balance of these compounds in the hops. And it is. You know, sometimes involves sacrificing a goat, dancing around the field naked at 4 a.m., you know.
There's a little voodoo involved.
A little bit of a voodoo, yeah. But okay. we're working on codifying our SOPs for the voodoo practice, okay. How we should say.
All right.
All right, some other ones we're going to look at is 3-MHA, and that's 3-MH acetate, basically. Yes.
Pretty close.
Looking for patent approval there.
Yeah. And that one's going to be a lot more tropical. That's guava and passion fruit. And again, on its own, it's kind of lightly tropical. And actually, it smells a little bit like butyric acid. So guava used to smell kind of not so nice. So same like papaya does too. Like I actually like eating it with lemon, but on its own, it reminds me of vomit.
Okay.
Butyric acid, basically, and isobutyric acid. But when in an acidic environment with a bunch of lime and maybe some salt and pepper or something like that, it completely changes the character and is this wonderful tropical fruity joy. It's the same sort of idea with these compounds. When you combine them, you get more than. You know, more than the sum of the parts.
Just like spices and food.
Exactly. They got to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you let them alone for a while to talk to each other, you might get some fights breaking out and you get some bitter and sort of acerbic compounds coming out. But in general, you get some really nice integrations.
Indian food's a great example of this because it's very strong in the spice department. But any one of those spices could be very harsh on its own. But the combination turns into amazing curry or you name it.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, like fenugreek is an example, is a great one for that from the Indian example. It smells kind of like maple syrup, fake maple syrup. Actually, that's what they use to make fake maple syrup. And on its own, it's actually quite bitter, but it smells sweet, so it's very confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But it lifts everything else and provides a real nice, solid, round base.
Got
for
it.
The food. So.
Okay.
Anyway, this is also incidentally why curry the next morning for breakfast is like the ideal hangover food. Because all the flavors have talked to each other and it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
That may be just me, but anyway. Right, so another one is 3-SH, which is 3-sulfonylhexan-1-ol. And that is what is...
You're getting better.
I am getting better. It's also written,
as it goes, right?
It's also written down in front of me, so that helps.
Oh.
Well, plus, I'm watching his beer go down, and as the beer goes down in his glass, he's getting better at the combos.
So it's like playing pool. Yeah. I have like a 3-beer minimum
right.
and a 6-beer maximum. So I'm just in the zone. I'm pretty decent at like 3 beers. As soon as beer five is done, and then I'm like, hey, I'm sick. All right. Yeah. So 3-SH is the compound that's responsible for driving, and it's not responsible for the aroma on its own, but it's responsible for driving the Sauvignon Blanc, melony, gooseberry, tropical, floral character that you get out of really nice New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs.
Which is an amazing thing to taste in beer and wine.
Oh, it's lovely. It's actually harder to pull out in beer because it's actually a fairly delicate character.
Okay.
And the weight of barley behind it. This is one of those compounds, and trying to make a beer like that, I think would be really good with the Brut style, the Brut IPA style, or a session style, because there's not a lot of malt backbone or a lot of other competing character behind it. And so that'll show up really nicely. And this is something to bear in mind. So like we had those wonderful strawberry sours at the Rare Barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Strawberry is actually really, really difficult to get to persist in most beer, not in sour beer, interestingly enough, but in regular beer. And this is we were talking about this earlier at lunch. It's a pH issue, and so those lighter characters like blueberry and strawberry, because strawberry and pineapple are virtual isomers of each other, and this 3-SH, those all work together to create a really wonderful profile.
Okay,
but you need to provide them the space to shine. You know, you need to give them a stage on their own rather than crowding them up with a bunch of spices and a bunch of, like, other esters and a big malt backbone flavor.
What I like about this one, too, is that it could give me the impression, if it were pronounced in a beer, this Sauvignon Blanc flavor, I would assume that they barrel-aged it, actually, that they put it in some kind of wine barrel. But you're telling me now they could even achieve that with just using hops.
I would typically go with an unoaked Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay.
And most Sauvignons, I'm sure, I'm not very familiar with many oaked ones, or like heavily oaked ones. They're neutral barrels at best. But it's more those real bright, light top notes. It's very floral, very just like when you open a really nice bottle of white wine, you're like, ooh, this smells and tastes like spring and summer.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
It's a little different. And so two other ones, we're just going to bust through these pretty quickly, is 3S4MP and 3S4MPA. And 3S4MP is the driver of grapefruit, and 3S4MPA is grapefruit and tropical, specifically passion fruit. And so those last three compounds, the 3-sulfonhexanol and 3S4MP and 3S4MPA, were all first identified in Sauvignon Blanc. And then Jacques Gros at ABI did a bunch of work and found those in a lot of hops in American varieties and in New Zealand varieties. So Nelson Sauvin, for example, actually does have these. So does Cascade and so does Amarillo, but it varies lot to lot. And
okay.
So this goes back to what I was saying about trying to, you know, the voodoo and the shepherding of the hops to make sure that these characters come out the way that we want.
You're also teaching me right now the chemical compounds of some of my favorite things, because those three hops that you just mentioned have always been some of my favorite. And Nelson, I find that one to be a little hit or miss among brewers. Some people love it, some people don't. I've always loved it, and all of these characteristics that you're now describing to me are in those hops.
I think this is actually a perfect time, thank you for that segue, to talk about blindness and sensitivity. And Tommy and I have noticed this before, like when we're doing sensory on hops, where we're, you know, we open up a bag and go, oh God, that's not good. And then come back, you know, 5 minutes later and smell it, it's like, oh, it actually smells pretty good. But then if we leave the room and come back, you know, half an hour later and smell it again, you're like, no, that's not good.
Wow.
So what happens is that you get really, really blind to sulfur compounds. And I've got a funny brewing story about this that I'll tell in a minute. But Tommy, what are some of the other things that we get blind to?
I mean, the biggest thing with the sulfur compounds is that they're basically a whole order of magnitude more noticeable. You can detect them down to the low parts per trillion, whereas most of the other compounds we're looking at are usually in the parts per billion or parts per million range. So, you know, if you're smelling a lot of it, it can really overwhelm you and, like Nick said, just make you blind to it almost instantaneously.
It actually kind of numbs your senses to it,
exactly.
Is what you're saying.
So, that smell didn't actually go away. You just lost track of it. So I always tell people when they're doing hop sensory or even beer sensory, if you think you smelled something, you probably did. You're probably not just making it up. You probably just got blind to it and it's gone.
So if you can't find it again later, you like to say, well, it doesn't mean it wasn't there. You should still write that down, for example.
Yeah, still trust your first instincts and you probably did smell it.
Okay.
Always go with your gut on sensory stuff. Like the first impression, okay, good, bad, ugly, whatever.
Take it. Okay.
I mean, the nose is probably better for smelling, but...
Yeah. There we go. First one's out.
I mean, Tommy's right.
He is. You're not wrong, Tommy. You're not wrong.
Yeah.
So I guess in that case, that's a so Pat, we were talking earlier about the part per trillion range, which was some of these compounds were some of these thiols, they were like 0.5 parts per trillion. So
yeah, almost 0.1 parts per trillion. So you're like, that's the threshold level. So just a little tiny bit, you're gonna sense it.
Which is really interesting is that these compounds occupy less than 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of the hop oils, which is frequently less than 1.5% of the volume of the hop, but they're the defining character. So it's kind of crazy to pay attention to this stuff. So analyzing this is a challenge because you have to have a whole bunch of different detectors. But the result is that you get some really nice complexity out of it. So
I'm going to change things up for you. If we're going to move on to esters, you think?
Yes.
At this point? All right. We're going to do a two-break show today.
Okay.
Just because I can. And when we come back, we're going to talk about esters. It's a good list here, and I just want to make sure that we have enough time to focus on that before we can move into how all these things can work in concert and some specific hop examples. So hang in there. You're listening to the Hop and Brew School podcast, and we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back to the Hop and Brew School podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. And today, of course, we were talking about hop combos and how the whole is greater than the sum of the parts when dealing with the different compounds found in hops. And we wanted to dive into esters this time, which I think people feel that they're familiar with. But we're going to talk about the chemical makeup of some of these things.
Indeed. Pat?
Esters, well, most of them derive from the fatty acids, and that's how they end up in the actual bract of the hop cone. And some of the more known ones are the methyl geraniate, which is basically a geraniol that's been esterified. So that's why it's actually kind of could be concerned in the terpene fraction as well, because it is like almost the same as geraniol, just with a methyl group added on.
Okay.
And so, Pat, how does that happen again? So, esterification is driven, you know, you have to have fatty acids and...
and an alcohol. So you have methanol bonded to geraniol acetate, essentially.
Yeah.
No, geraniol.
Geraniol, yeah. Sorry.
And that one... chemists are upset now.
So that's okay. They'll go back to their lab and pipette with fury.
That's right.
So methyl geraniate is typically a fruity and waxy aromatic character with apple lift. And waxy is a really hard one for me to detect. And really, I only detect it when it's in really high levels, and it tastes and smells kind of like wax,
like candle wax.
Like if you had just
an unscented,
like
candle,
a totally neutral candle. So not like any pencil dust shavings you get in some of the colored ones, but a completely neutral candle wax. Obviously not beeswax, but it'll smell kind of waxy.
Okay,
and not in a bad way. It's an odd one.
Okay, yeah, I'd have a hard time picking that up too.
All right, next.
Well, my next favorite one actually is because of the fact that it wasn't something I would have looked at or detected. Well, actually, I detected it on the GCMS, but I wouldn't have looked at it because it was so small and tiny. I actually have an olfactory port where people were actually smelling this one, so then it became of interest to me because it may have been a small, tiny blip on my GCMS, but it's important to the nose, so now I accept it.
Yeah, okay.
So this one's a 1-butanol, 3-methanol propionate, which kind of is a fruity odor. Some people have gotten peach off it. Tommy's actually the one that called it peach. So that one's been a really neat new one that I found that I really was excited about.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned that it could show up in really small quantities in your instruments, but if people are picking it up, we can't ignore it. It's important.
Yeah, it makes it, puts it at the top of the...
Sure.
Top of the level there.
Okay.
And I mean, that's what's really cool is that, again, I've said it before, is that the best GCMS is the one on your face. You know, not wearing it, Tommy. just, you know, sticking your nose in things. And if you detect it, you know, trust yourself. If you smell it, it's there. No matter what it reminds you of. But if you smell something, even if you can't identify it, then there's something going on there. And if you like it or you don't like it, that's what matters. So figure out where that's coming from and adjust accordingly.
Okay. What's next?
One of those a little more common is 2-methylbutyl isobutyrate, which is...
I'm just laughing because I'm looking at the notes and that word. And Pat, I'm so glad you're here because I would have butchered that. Say it again for me.
2-methylbutyl isobutyrate.
Okay. That's all one word, folks. And what does that give us?
That's kind of a bananas character. It actually... people believe it to be derived from actually the alpha acids as degradation product. But it is pretty common to see...
okay.
And your chromatograms are as a ester to be found. So,
and again, I love learning about this in hops because if ever I'm sensing banana, you know, I think like a lot of people, I blame yeast first, right? I go straight to yeast on that one.
Well, that's what we're in. I'm going to get into those esters after these hop derived ones. So these are all hop derived, and then the next set is going to be a little bit of yeast derived stuff.
Okay.
And speak on to that, because being a person who's behind the scenes that looks at data, sometimes when I smell hops, me knowing the compound ratios they have, it affects what I actually sense. Because
I
think I sense banana all the time, because I know this hop is supposed to have a lot of 2-methylbutyl isobutyrate. Even though it may not be there for everybody else around me, but for me, it's there.
And because you're not doing a blind sensing.
Yeah. Especially if they gave me the variety, then it's like instantaneous. I'm going to give you back what I know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Our brain dictates our senses in those ways.
And that's why, to all of our Yakima Chief listeners, we need more of you in sensory and at the olfactory port, please.
All right, what's next?
Methyl octanoate. That's a pretty prevalent one in hops, it seems. Even though we don't seem to really actually be able to smell it through the GCMS, so it becomes like it's high amounts, it appears in the hops, but people who are actually using the olfactory port are not smelling it. So you're like, do I really care at this time for this compound, even though it's at such a high level in the hop itself?
Okay. So you're more just kind of collecting data when you see that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe it actually turns up in the beer, and maybe someone will actually catch it out of the beer, or it will act in synergy with other esters,
right?
And maybe it'll pick up.
So yeah, we're doing a lot of statistic analysis of this stuff. So I guess one of the questions that I have is that, you know, this is an ester, so it's a formation, or it's formed of methanol and a fatty acid. And so what happens when, because those esterification reactions are reversible in complex, so you can actually have something that starts out as an ester and then turns into its constituent components and vice versa. They can change over time depending on the conditions.
I see.
So is it possible that methyl octanoate could end up as octanoic acid?
Oh, yes, I would say so.
Which
yes,
is, absolutely. Isn't that the goaty, sweaty?
Yep, that'll become a goaty smell to you.
And okay.
Sometimes in hops, you do actually find octanoic acid, and be my guess that it is actually just a breakdown of methyl octanoate by acid hydrolysis or something like
that. Okay. So it matters.
Yeah, it does matter. And it matters.
Yeah.
And that's the point, is that these may matter in a negative way, or they may matter in a positive way. What's really interesting is because these things are reversible, if you think about aged hops where the octanoate has broken down into octanoic acid, then you put those aged hops in an environment that becomes alcoholic and acidic and full of turbid wort, therefore many, many wort lipids.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think happens? So lambics, when you're using these old hops, like isovaleric acid, for example, that's a very common feature in very old, aged, oxidized hops.
Mm-hmm.
You can end up with isovalerate, which actually has a more fruity character that develops. And
okay.
So looking at just the chemistry, not even taking into account, you know, the, was it 471 flavor active components of lambic? There's a very high probability that these compounds, these precursors, are being changed into some really interesting aromatic stuff. And so there's a lot of work to be done. So I'm excited to start looking at it.
And it keeps me busy in the job.
That's
great.
Hey, yeah. Dude.
Pat, I think you're going to be fine, man.
Yeah.
You're going to get to choose when you retire. The work isn't going to choose for you.
That, you know, you don't understand that the lab is locked and controlled.
And so
just
is
to
Pat.
Keep me in. Yeah, it's basically to keep me in.
Yeah, it goes back to the lab, analyze the samples, or it gets the hose again.
Yeah, I like that Pat's like out in the world for the first time right
yes.
now.
There's sunlight.
Sun. Thank you that you sent me to California. So
there you go.
So I got to see some sun.
Nick's looking out for you, man.
I'm trying.
I think it's more because he wants to keep you around, get a little vitamin D back in you, and then back in the lab, man.
Having rickets would just be really bad for Pat.
All right, what's next on our list?
Well, another close compound to octanoate is methyl heptanoate. Again, it's another one that's pretty high on the instrument, so I get a pretty good response back in every hop, but it doesn't seem to be detectable by people's noses and the olfactory port. So, but again, it can form heptanoic acid, which would become another cheesy odor to you, pretty close to the goaty. So,
and so that's actually a really good thing is to mention. And thanks for that, Pat. Is the looking at esters, because they're very, very aromatically important in beer, but in hops, a lot of them the hops that have high levels of esters already are the ones that tend to develop cheesy characters and oxidized characters pretty quickly.
I see.
So you know, there are certain ones that we recognize as being really, really high esters, and we have to treat those very, very carefully and process them very, very quickly, because we want to make sure that they don't start to go that path. But again, in the right matrix, those things can convert back into some of these really nice esters. And so, you know, looking at this going forward, we're going to try to develop a lot more data on this, is understanding what's the balance, what's the threshold. You know, even if you have a cheesy hop, if you're using it in the right situation, it might actually provide you a better result than a hop that might smell brilliant.
Oh, see, that would be amazing, too. I can't imagine brewers coming in and going, yeah, yeah, I'll go ahead and take the cheesy one because I know it's going to turn into something good.
You'd be surprised.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We've had some requests for like, oh, no, I'm sorry. You've overaged these hops. They don't smell enough like feet.
Wow.
It's like, what?
Yeah. Tommy, you have this experience too where a hop can almost be offensive when you smell it but turn out to be something wonderful?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a possibility, like Nick was saying, with those bad flavors reconverting into flavors you actually want. And I think you see that a lot with lambic beers and sours that
have low pH.
Do you think it's exclusive to those beers?
I'm not really sure.
Okay. In other words,
I think the low pH does help, but...
In other words, you don't have some major example of a cheesy, footy hop that turned out wonderful in a fresh pale ale or a fresh IPA?
I don't personally, but...
Yeah, okay. Doesn't mean it's not there, I guess.
I actually do.
Really?
Have, and it was actually with the kettle sour. And so this pretty much ruled out biotransformation in this particular case. And it was a turbid one, but it was... I used some 4.5-year-old Sriracha Ace that had been open. And I was like, I might as well go kind of traditional with it and chucked it in there because I wanted to get... It still had a bit of a Sriracha's character to it.
Mm-hmm.
And what it ended up coming through was just fruit.
Okay. But that in a kettle sour, it still had the pH to help it out.
Correct.
Okay.
It's the key is esterification is going to involve fatty acids, an acidic environment, alcohol, and, you know, a substrate of some kind. So,
okay. All right, what's next so we can get through these?
All right, these next couple are going to be yeast-derived, and this goes back to what you were saying. So one of the big banana ones, as you mentioned, is isoamyl acetate, and that is legit one of the fake banana flavors they use to make banana gum and all that stuff. So it's just basically, and it tastes, it's actually the major flavor compound for one of the landrace bananas that is now extinct because of various parasites and diseases, but it's what... You know, the tiny little red bananas smell and taste like. They're just the most banana-y banana ever that ever bananaed.
Okay.
And isoamyl acetate, that's, as you know, those are that's one of the things that is formed by the POF-positive yeasts, and it's also formed by some of the stronger strains when they're fermenting at higher temperatures and at higher ABVs. So like 1272, so the American Ale 2 yeast, that will kick out a lot of isoamyl acetate if you give it enough juice, meaning enough sugar, mm-hmm. and enough of higher temperature, and enough hot material, you're going to get a lot of these fruit characters in there.
Okay.
And the link between the formation of a lot of these yeast-derived or fermentation-derived esters and sort of incoming, I guess, substrates to work on from hops or from other ingredients isn't fully understood, but we know the chemistry enough about how that happens that we can make some pretty educated guesses.
Okay.
Ethyl lactate's a really good one, and that is pineapple. And that's the one that you want some lactic acid and some ethanol in the place for. And you're going to end up with, if you can get that to form, you're going to end up with a very strong pineapple character. Ethyl hexanoate is actually a sign, an indicator of yeast stress. And it tastes like Red Delicious apples and aniseed. Aniseed at a low, about a 33 to 66% ratio to apple.
Is that licorice? Is that anise you're talking about? Or is it different?
It's not quite licorice. Licorice okay. is a lot harsher and darker and deeper.
Okay.
Anise is the little seeds that are kind of licorice-y.
Okay.
It's the same compound, but it bound up with a bunch of others. And you can smell that a lot in beers where they have been underpitched or the yeast is serially stressed. And in a small volume, it can actually add a pleasant character to beer, mm-hmm. which is why some people will intentionally underpitch some of their beers. But at high levels, it can be just overwhelming. And then the other one is ethyl butyrate. And this is what's really interesting is that so butyric acid, feet, vomit, baby vomit, just disgustingness.
Mm-hmm.
But ethyl butyrate is the ester. And that is fruity and tropical fruity. And its threshold is quite low, just like butyric acid. But when it gets really, really high, it goes back to smelling kind of like way overripe fruit and vomit. But at low levels, it is a major contributor to overall fruity character. And so if you have some fruity hops, like you have some that have the 1-butanol-3-methylpropanoate, peach, or methylgeronate, and you've got some 3-SF4-MPA, which is the passion fruit and grapefruit, combine those with something that has a yeast that's a heavy ethyl butyrate producer, and you're going to end up with like crazy fruit salad. So that's kind of the idea where we're going with this.
All right. I love it. It's interesting. You must have taken some background knowledge just from food science. I mean, I've known for years, I hope most people do, that McDonald's, for example, manufactures the flavors that we taste, and they do it from some of these esters. I think it was, what's the book I read years ago about McDonald's taking over the world or something. But they were, you know, they described in a chapter about how food science, and they're able to just place some of these compounds on the French fries and on the hamburgers and on the food to accentuate them. I guess in McDonald's case, they're not accentuating things like banana and fruit, but they are accentuating something. Mm-hmm. So while I think that you're sort of on an island figuring out these hop compounds, Pat, there must be a body of work that even just comes from food science that helps you with these things.
Yeah, I mean, just the general basics of chemistry for myself, and then just trying to research as much as you possibly can about what's known out there.
Yeah,
kind of helps you bring it together as much as you possibly can. But I mean, having all the compounds, like the way I'm analyzing them is trying to get every little exact compound that I possibly can and find them all. But I also need sensory and that body of work from like our sensory group.
Right.
So I can combine it with that knowledge. Otherwise, it means nothing.
Right. Well, it means something to you, but yeah, not to the rest of us.
I mean, I like the numbers and I think it's cool that I can find all this, but if it right. doesn't really help, then what does it do for anybody?
Absolutely. Then you are out of a job. You can go do that stuff on your own.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, 1 second, Justin, here, because the interesting thing about that is that when you talk about food science and sort of cooking, as like so imagine trying to model what's going on in a pan making a curry, going back to the Indian thing. You've got, generally about, 8 to 12 spice combinations, plus some vegetables, plus the water, plus some citrus, plus all these things, and changing pHs and volatilization, all that stuff. That's a huge amount of stuff to model. Well, you have all that in the boil. Then you have fermentation and biotransformation.
Right.
Then you have 1,715 plus compounds from hops, however many from malt, however many from the salts, and a changing ionic balance, and then what the yeast brought with it and what the yeast is exchanging with the environment. Trying to model that is profoundly different from, doing the science of cooking. It's not easy to model cooking recipes, and people typically don't, unless they're focusing on something very, very sort of focused, like, say, hamburgers and French fries.
Yeah.
And if you're only focusing on that, then you can, there's not that much going on there.
Sure.
You can complicate as much as you want and make some wonderful things.
Right.
But on their own, it's pretty much meat, bread, cheese, pickles, salt, and so combining those things is a lot easier to sort of play with.
Yeah.
I'm not a food scientist. I'm not saying your job is easy. It's hard as hell.
No, just describing the different complexities that brewers have to deal with. And in fact, it's helping me understand more in the history of the Brewing Network shows. We've always, some professional brewers will give us their recipes and some won't. Mm-hmm. And the ones that do have always said, you can have my recipe. It's fine. You're still not going to make the same beer. Nobody can ever really makes the same beer, and it's because of this myriad differences that happen. The recipe's not the only thing. All of those other conditions are what's going to matter too.
Yeah, I mean, it's as I've said, as a professional brewer, it's far more about process than it is about recipe.
Yeah.
The recipe might be, some people say 10%. I'm going to go with less than 5% of the importance.
Wow.
It's really how you do it, what you track, and your ingredient selection, and your management of the process. And, in terms of other brewers and stuff, and what I loved about, like, you guys' Can You Brew It show, is that it showed that you could make a beer that was sensorily identical to the source or the inspiration beer.
Mm-hmm.
But used an entirely different process and recipe to get there.
Yeah.
The one that comes to mind is the Arrogant Bastard.
Which we could never quite get right.
You could never quite get right according to them, but you got pretty close to it enough that people wouldn't really be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that's kind of the thing, is that using, they're like, oh yeah, none of that stuff is in that recipe. But, you put two of them in front of you and you're like, oh, well, they taste kind of the same.
Right. For those of you who aren't familiar with that show, it is a great example. It's called Can You Brew It? It's on thebrewingnetwork.com. And our two hosts, Jamil Zanishev and Tasty McDole, would try to clone their favorite recipes or our listeners' favorite recipes. And they were criticized early on because the first half of the show would be a direct interview with the brewer where the brewer would give the exact recipe. And Jamil would probe him further for what his water profile looked like, and he would probe him further for what his fermentation looked like. And listeners very early on criticized, like, well, of course you can brew it. You just interviewed the guy and got all the information. But I'll tell you what, the ratio of failures and successes was fairly even. Even with all of that information, they could still... There was a scale issue. There's all these different compounds you're talking about. There's
a different process issue.
Yeah, the lot of ingredients that came in was different than what the... So, yeah, we quickly waved off that criticism because we found they found themselves failing anyway and then would have to go back and make different adjustments to try to get it right. So, great example. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we're actually going to talk about... we're going to give you a whole bunch of different hops that contain some of these components we've been talking about and give you some real-world examples. So, hang in there. It's the Hop and Brew School podcast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hop and Brew School podcast. Thanks for joining us today. We have been going over all the different hop combinations and the combos of their chemical makeup. And now we're going to get into some real world stuff here. And I think what we've got to do is give us a nice list of hops that contain some of these certain compounds in higher amounts.
That is the plan.
Okay.
As well as looking at some combinations to try to drive certain character in the beer.
Okay.
So just quick two notes. One of the things that I wanted to sort of highlight here is about the thiols. You know, these are fairly volatile compounds, so they're gonna come a lot from dry hopping, and maybe some of them might persist through. There's some more work to be done there, but you got to be real careful about contact with reactive metals after you've introduced the hops, because copper will strip out any of the sort of the sulfonyl group thiols, and what ends up happening is that they bind to the copper. And we'll not make it into your wort. They won't stay there.
Okay.
So that's just an observation.
You're talking specifically about brewing equipment.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You gotta watch out for that. I mean, you gotta have the right equipment for the right job.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So we were then talking about hop lists. Although there was a blindness story that I think is the Nick's Brewing Foibles 103.
Mm-hmm.
So Tommy, we talked about how we had gotten blind to some characters, some of the thio characters and some of the thio ester characters, meaning the sort of old veg, broccoli juice left out the night before.
Yeah,
aromas. Yes, and how when you open a bag, sometimes those will just volatilize off. So come back to it a few minutes later, and you can usually smell it, and the hops will be fine. But so, Tommy, you must have experienced sulfur blindness before.
Yeah.
Often?
I mean, with hops, it has happened quite a bit. Smelling some of the onion garlic flavors and aromas, they will tend to dissipate after your first initial smell. And having smelled over 1,000 samples this year, that did happen a lot.
Okay.
And it kind of made me confused whether or not I was smelling it, but again, just kind of trusting myself and
right.
But it does happen quite a bit.
I feel like you got benched for a little while. I would bench him. Like,
no, he benched himself.
He did.
And so that's the thing, is that you have to recuse yourself.
Right.
If you've got a cold, you can't do it.
Okay.
Also, interestingly enough, I found this anecdotally. I had shoulder surgery when I was at BrewDog, and I had these. They didn't give me any decent painkillers. They just gave me freaking like ibuprofen, but like a lot of it.
Yeah, the Europeans don't know about good opioids.
Oh no, they the thing is, they give them out over the counter. It's a little scary.
Oh, I see.
I don't actually like opioids; they're nasty.
Okay.
But the what I found though is that ibuprofen made my nose completely numb, and I've noticed this time and time again. So I'll smell something, take some ibuprofen, and then like 20 minutes later, can't smell it.
Okay,
don't detect anything. So it's just to be aware of that. But so there's also personal blindnesses. So like I'm blind to certain characters that are might described as multi-biscuity or a like this one that's like grainy, but I'm hypersensitive to other things like THP, tetrahydroxypyridine. Yeah,
Tommy for the win.
Tommy for the win. He comes in from behind. Tommy, you're not sensitive to DMS, right?
No, almost not at all. It kind of took having a. An experience seeing a kettle boil with the lid still on to make me really experience it.
Okay.
So that's almost my threshold.
It had to be at a really high concentration.
Well, the entire brewery smelled like you know, Frito-Lays and corn.
Yeah.
It was impressive.
And
like,
Tommy was just hungry for lunch.
No, Tommy's like, oh, hey, is that TMS? Yeah. I smell it.
It was actually really exciting because I almost hadn't smelled it before.
Wow.
It took like 15 times concentration to really detect it.
Before. And everybody has these
Everybody things, has so. These blindnesses. Yeah. So, for example, Pat is extraordinarily susceptible to an as yet unidentified compound in melon. And it's not cis-3-hexanol, which is what I thought it was. That's the fresh, green, grassy, melon, rindy character.
Mm-hmm.
Melons basically suck.
Dude, come on. Who doesn't love good melon? Melons.
It's just too... It's your kryptonite. It's too powerful.
Yes.
I had a slice of cantaloupe at breakfast the morning before last, and Pat sits down next to me. He's like, get that shit away from me. Right. So the brewing foible, beyond our blindnesses and sensitivities and stuff, is the... So we had a beer, or it was actually a braggot, it's amazing braggot, but it involved a lot of rhubarb and a lot of honey. I mean, it was, 49% honey. So it was legally, we called it a braggot. You couldn't do any more than that. But it had, it must have been 2 or 3 pallets of rhubarb in it, and it tasted amazing. It was just crazy. But rhubarb is completely full of thiols, particularly 3-MH. And it's also got a lot of sulfur in it because of the way they fertilize and the way they spray and stuff like that. So we rinsed it all off. We cleaned it. But even having it in the beer, during fermentation, it was like, wow, man, Scott, are you just having eggs every day for breakfast or something? It was just, it just smelled like H2S in the whole brewery. And then so we processed it, but it had been smelling that way for like a week. So we processed it, centrifuged it, sent it to the bright tank. Great. All things good. Then we did it on a Friday, came back on Monday, and we're like, oh, man, that's not good. That smells like rotten eggs.
We're still there. Okay.
We're still there. So we had to burp it and try to off-gas it. And so we did that. Special human being that I am, I didn't have the off-gas pipe going out of the brewery.
Oh, no.
So I was off-gassing into the brewery.
Right.
And at first we're like, oh, that smells terrible. And after about 3 or 4 minutes, everybody's like, oh, yeah, no, it's fine. It's probably okay now. We tasted it. Like, yeah, I can't smell anything.
Oh,
we were all completely blind to it.
Sure.
And we had to recall the entire batch because I forgot to take into account the fact that you get blind to sulfur compounds, particularly H2S, very quickly.
Okay.
And this is why people stay married.
Yeah.
You get blind to eggy farts very, very quickly.
That's right. I mean, there's an evolutionary makeup to this. Right?
Oh, absolutely. It's all of our sensitivities and blindnesses are evolutionary driven, including the blindness to stinky farts.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's give a list of hops. How about some high terpene hops?
Tommy doesn't have a list in front of him. All right, there we go.
Oh, you left him.
I left him hanging.
Yeah, I'll help you.
I can, yeah.
All right. Well,
we can straight from the GCMS.
All right, yeah. So I'm just going off the Pat's data here, but some of the high terpene hops that we have specifically, Citra is, I think, the highest completely, and then Equinot Pato, which is our new HBC 682, which just named back in August, I believe.
Filling in for Alex.
Very nice.
Yeah, so that's another high one. That's a super high alpha as well. So kind of a different use profile there, possibly. But
what are characteristics of that? I've never heard of that hop. Obviously,
It's kind of got a orangey citrus.
Okay,
and a lot of spice cake kind of in the background there. So it's a very spicy, like deep dark spices, like clove, cinnamon, and then. It's in really high concentrations, it smells kind of like Christmas cake.
Interesting. Okay.
You can have like a 20% alpha.
Wow. Yes. Really?
It's awesome.
Okay. Pato.
And then I think the last one we had on the list was Centennial.
And Sabro. Yeah. And that's the HBC 438. Yeah. No, but so those are all really high ester hops. And what's interesting is...
High terpene?
Terpene. I'm sorry. My bad.
High terpene. I'm learning, guys, because I can now correct Nick.
Yes, please.
Good thing we gave you the list.
That's right.
Oh, God. Yeah, because I'm clearly reading the list. So those are the high terpene ones.
Okay.
And which will then... Those are going to be the sort of the straight terpenes that are going to drive a lot of those are very aromatic in the hop themselves, but those are also going to be some of those will persist in the beer. That's really nice. But then you also get the next class, which is the high terpene alcohol ones.
Okay.
And those are the linalools, geraniols, and then the things that lead to citronellol and nerol.
Okay. So these are kind of the lifters.
Exactly.
Okay. And things that might evolve in the brewing process.
Very much so.
Okay.
And the king of these, as Pat has pointed out, is laurel. It has the absolute highest proportion of linalool and it also has one of the highest quantities of linalool. So it's a very high oil and very high linalool heavy hop. And so it's just, it just really contributes a great deal to any citrusy beer that you want to do. Citra, we know this as well. It's a that's one of its defining characteristics.
Also on the first list of mm-hmm. high terpene, Citra is a high terpene alcohol. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sabro again as well. What's interesting is you don't have Pato on this list. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have the doesn't have the native terpene alcohols, or doesn't have as high a level as the native terpene alcohols as the others. I'm going to figure out what that means eventually. Excuse me. We're going to figure out what that means eventually because but when you look at some of the other other hops, what's interesting is that Centennial's on that list as well, but Crystal and Triumph are really really high in there. And Crystal isn't a super high oil hop.
Okay.
But it has a really high proportion of these terpene alcohols to it. So bang for buck for these particular compounds, if you're trying to make a complex, but you don't want to get too much other vegetable matter in there or too much other hoppy character in there, you know, you might want to try combining some of these things like a little touch of Crystal or some Centennial, which have these, but maybe it may not be super expressive in other ways. Centennial's pretty expressive across the board, but Crystal's actually pretty... It plays well with others.
Okay.
And so that's one of those ones you might want to combine to just bump up your linalool level without bumping up a lot of anything else.
So for these, what kind of proportion would you normally use? Somewhere around like 15% as a lifter? Or
now that, see, this goes into to later on, but I guess really what it is what are you trying to achieve? So again, you're not only going to be getting just one of these compounds into your beer. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to get the entire thing that the hop contributes. So, for example, Sabro is very flavor forward in pretty much always. Like it has, it contributes pineapple, coconut, extremely high levels. It can contribute a little bit of dillness, like sort of like that's a New Mexicanus. These are all New Mexicanus traits. Mm-hmm. It'll contribute lots of lime, but you know, between 5% and 15% charge, it will lift all these other citrus hops and all these other hops up, just entropical hops, up way high.
Okay.
And so I actually, with Sabro, I love the hop. It's fantastic. You can make a wonderful single hop beer with it. But I really advocate combining it with some of the ones that have these other high terpene alcohols, and all some of these other, some of the thiols.
But you're not certain, back to Tommy's question, in like what percentage to combine them.
Oh, no. So Sabro, so one of my favorite beers is a Sabro Simcoe Cascade and Equinaut, mm-hmm. and Sabro is like 5% of that charge. And when, you know, during fermentation, all you smell is Sabro. And then during dry hop, you know, you don't, the Sabro doesn't take over. You can detect it in the background, but everything else is just blowing up in your face.
And is that, Tommy, is that your experience too, even with some other, like Crystal was one that you mentioned would be a great bang for your buck. Are you finding in the 5 to 6% range? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sabro is the most expressive on that list.
Okay.
Like Nick said, I've had a 5% Sabro beer that was still dominatingly Sabro. So,
interesting, okay. But others, you might be able to go up to 15 or 20.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you were doing like a Laurel with Citra, I think that's a good combination where if you did a 20-80 or something like that, or add something else in there as well.
Okay.
Because Laurel by itself is still a great hop, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of underutilized.
And that's kind of when you get to the thiol and the sulfonyl thiols. Like if you're trying to elevate either tropical fruit or citrus, so Laurel has all of the building blocks. Laurel and Citra have all of these massive building blocks for citrus beers, but they may not have enough of the high thiol or sulfonyl thiols to kick them up that notch. So chuck in some Cascade, chuck in some Equinaut, chuck in some Mosaic as a lifter to contribute to those, and it's just going to go boom, and it's going to just kick it up a notch.
And just looking at my notes here, I think it's worth pointing out that so far of the list we've talked about, high terpene alcohol, and now you just mentioned high thiol and sulfonyl thiol, Citra is on every one of these so far.
Citra is actually on all of these so far.
So, well, we haven't even gotten to the last one yet. Mm-hmm. So now you just gave it away that Citra is going to make it on all of them, Nick. I was building up some anticipation. It was a mystery. My big bang was going to be, look at Citra's on all of them. And what do? You run it over like a freight train.
I'm sorry, Justin. Please forgive me.
It's the first time you've gotten scolded on the podcast, too. All right. So on today's show, we've got our first quote, our first quotable quote, and Nick's first scolding.
Feels bad.
Okay, but Citra is high thiol and sulfonyl thiol.
Mm-hmm.
Amarillo?
Yep, and that's what's interesting is that Amarillo and Citra both have that pretty distinct earthy, dusty character in the background And, you know, depending on the grower, depending on the region, that'll express more or less.
Okay.
And that's described as that, I think that's that 3MH, where it's a rhubarb slash citrus character. And it's because they're very, very strongly associated with the 3MHA, which is also a citrus character. But that rhubarb character is, when you have rhubarb, there is a bizarre rhubarbiness to it, but there's also a very strong earthy component to that mix of compounds.
Okay.
I've had batches of Citra where people are like, oh my God, the Citra just smells super earthy. I'm like, yeah, no, that's actually part of the variety. That's within spec. It's just a different expression of that variety.
I see.
And it is actually within spec. It has the right balance. It has the right alpha balance. It has the right oil balance. It's just that it's more towards earthy than towards citrus.
Okay.
But if you combine that with some other more citrusy lots of Citra, or more citrusy lots of like Laurel.
That sounds great.
It's going to go boof and get real. Boof is the lifting hand for those of you not watching the video.
And boof is also the scientific term for what?
For le bouffage, which is the way that you increase the volumetric volume of a hot air balloon with hot words. But yeah, basically, you'll just lift those things up.
Okay. What else is on the high thiol and sulfonyl thiol list?
Equinot.
Yeah, and this is another one that's pretty much everywhere.
Okay.
And this kind of goes back to what I was talking about multiple times, is how Equinot was kind of meh until it grew up and then got through its awkward teenage phase, and now is just banging. Mm. It's just expressive in every which way.
Okay.
Another thing with Equinot, it is one of those hops that have a lot of oil content, so that's why you see it on a lot of this list.
I see.
Yeah.
And by the way, some of the most popular hops are on all of these lists, right?
Yeah. So it really just stands out.
Yeah.
Now you figure it out, what people have already told us, and now we're finding the data supports that.
I understand. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So when we're breaking it down, looking at it, saying, oh, so, this is why people like it.
Right.
So you guys kind of gave me a jump start.
Yeah.
I already knew what to look for.
Worked backwards from what brewers were liking, consumers were liking.
Yeah.
And now you're telling us why.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. It's a good team. This is some teamwork we got going on here.
You make beer that we like to drink, and we will use that to determine what hops to give you.
Right.
Yeah.
Just
very
kidding.
Symbiotic. All right. And then our last group here would be high ester hops, right?
Oh, and look, Citra's on that list.
Citra's on
that list. Wow. What a surprise. What a shot.
Sorry, guys.
That's it. Tommy, you're in. Nick's out. No, here we go. What are some of the hops we can find in the high ester category?
Well, the king of them is, again, Equinot,
mm-hmm.
because he's got the high oil content. And in this list with the esters, he's actually the top.
Okay.
He has the most of all of them, so he's the king.
Got it.
And
I believe that's a she.
Okay. Is it? All right.
I believe they're all she's.
They're all she's.
All right, they are.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
You can't blame Pat. He's stuck in the lab.
He's gender blind.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The thing has to be.
That's right. What's next?
Citra, of course.
Yeah.
Because everybody knew that was coming.
Uh-huh.
And then Laurel again.
Okay.
And then, of course, you got Simcoe, Centennial, and Chinook finally makes it to the list. What do you know?
Right. There it is.
Actually, Chinook should be on the high
thiol.
Yeah,
he's high thiol, too.
Yeah.
So. I'm sorry. You didn't proofread my list.
There was a burger.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you make it during lunch.
That's right.
Sorry. I woke up late. All right.
All right. And let me just say this. What I'll do is post these lists in our show notes so you can come back and take a look at these things if you're ever, you follow along with the show and sit down and plan your beer based on some of the things we've talked about. And we do have enough time to give a case example here.
Yeah, and so actually going forward, more than just posting the show notes, one of the things that we're going to try to work on is, as we get more data, we don't have a total long-running series yet, where we are still compiling it,
mm-hmm.
is I'd like to be able to provide remember the old hop oil chart?
Yes.
We're going to do a further breakdown of that. And so major components and minor components. And so that will be able to allow brewers to, or give brewers the tools to really combine things in a cool way.
Great.
But that's coming in a while. Quickly, on the high ester ones, what's really interesting, and Pat, you clued me into this, is that based on your knowledge of chemistry and the analysis that you do, the esters are mostly resident in the bract fraction, right?
Yes.
And so what's interesting about that is that if you think back to trying to make beers with only extract, or the descriptions of some people saying, if I just make only a cryo double IPA, it seems to be missing something. Mm. What's interesting is it might be that these esters. So we're gonna have to dig into that some more.
Okay.
But what's really lovely about it is that you can then control it better. And so if you want to bump up your ester profile, stick in something that's got a little bit more leaf material.
Got it.
Try to balance it out. The other thing we've noticed is that the high ester profiles are also the things that are the ones that can go kind of off pretty quick.
Kind of get cheesy.
Okay.
So you have to be real careful about how you store these high ester varieties. So you want to keep them cold as heck and anoxic. So keep them in the package as much as possible. If you have an open bag, you know, squeeze all the air out of it. Fill it full of CO2, squeeze it all again, fill it full of CO2, squeeze it all again. Like, get as much air of that as you possibly can.
Okay.
And make sure that CO2 is coming in at the very bottom of the pellet, so you're driving everything out. And then vacuum seal it.
And then by cold, am I putting them in my fridge or my freezer if I'm
freezer.
A home brewer? In my freezer.
Freezer.
Okay.
So, I ideally minus 80 C. But most people don't have those.
Right.
So most big chest freezers.
Just in the lab.
Yeah.
Most big chest freezers will go down below minus 20 or minus 40.
Okay.
So you're okay. But that's one of the things. Like, so you look at things like Centennial, very high ester hop and has very, very lovely characteristics. Hmm. But if you don't store it right, it can go really quite cheesy quite quickly.
Okay.
And so what's interesting is that we're looking at it and going, huh, well, we've got some of this stuff as bracked. Let's see if we can sort of get that stuff into some lambics and see what happens, because I think that would be really cool to see.
Okay.
Because if we're right about this, you know, then these things could be a source of major fruit-forward flavors from these oxidized esters.
Got it.
Or degraded esters.
Then we're not going to use strawberries no more?
Uh-oh.
No, I want to eat the strawberries with balsamic and drink the beer with the hops. All right. Tommy, this is something where I think we can talk about. Actually, this is probably a good segue into that. The beer that so there's a couple of beers we had with some of the noble blends we had, like the Independence blend, mm-hmm. that has picked up some traction with some people because it delivers a really apparently quite fruity character.
Yeah, well, actually, we kind of had a little bit of an issue with it. Brewed the beer, and so I think it was with the Independence blend, which mm-hmm. is 20% whole cone hops, and then the rest is an American noble blend. So it's kind of an in-between type of blend, but I think we were targeting some kind of American Pilsner type of style. It's a lower alpha and
a little bit more fruity and more assertive than normal.
And we packaged it into a keg and started carbonating it. And me and Nick tasted it, and it frankly was not that great. Kind of had
that's
like
an understatement.
Okay,
we thought it was
trying to be nice.
No, but let's be honest here, because it started out we were going, "Holy crap, this is oxidized! It smells like it had been, you know." Packaged with oxygen, it smelled like it had, you know, it had this weird, it wasn't quite diacetyl, it was this other character, it definitely had isovaleric acid mm-hmm. in it. It was just full of weirdness.
Wow.
Yeah, it was frankly not a great beer, but whatever, we left it on the CO2, let it carbonate fully, and let it rest for another week or two.
It wasn't even a week or two, it was just a couple of days.
Yeah, and it totally cleared up, and it was
really
this great pineapple tropical flavor. It was really surprising. And
so these are some of these changes that happen that Pat's teaching me about in whether in fermentation or post fermentation they could be happening still, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And bringing out better qualities.
Could just be the pH, because after fermentation your pH drops. So
right,
and with the addition of CO2, you're going to add carbonic acid, which is going to drop it further. So
this is interesting too. Again, through the history of our show, when we've been teaching homebrewers here on the Brewing Network. Jamil and Doc and some of our cast have always told our homebrewers, don't throw the beer out yet. Just wait. Like there's a point where you know that you've failed. But they
when
always
you need the keg.
But they always said, yeah, just wait. And oftentimes the beers have turned out better. But we were never talking about the chemical process that was happening. We were just saying, we don't know, beer gets better sometimes. Just wait.
Right. And so we're trying to figure out what the voodoo is.
Right. Okay.
So, I mean, what's interesting about that one is that, you know, we wanted a little bit of fruit, but we didn't specifically target pineapple. And actually, the 20% of leaf that's in that one is actually Simcoe, which is not something I would ever associate with pineapple. Pine, yes. Mm-hmm. And sort of generic fruitiness, yes, but not pineapple.
Right.
And in concert with the other noble varieties, so the noble fractions of the other varieties. What seems to be coming out is this very expressive, very distinct ethyl lactate, pineapple, and some you know, ethyl butyrate tropical fruit character. And we've seen this not only in the beer that Tommy made, but also in the commercial brews of this. So the one in Nashville that we had for CBC.
Are you talking about the Cascadian?
No, the one that the lovely folks who hosted us in Nashville for the meeting.
Oh, yeah, at Tailgate?
Yeah, at Tailgate. They made a beer with the Independence Plan, and it was really good.
Okay.
It was really distinctly pineapple. And this has shown up again and again. So some other people have experienced it, and it's really interesting. So this kind of gives weight to, you know, I was kind of like, nah, Pat, the esters have got to be in the lupulin fraction, but apparently that may not be true.
Interesting.
Or not all of them. So it's going to be really interesting to see.
All right, lots to learn here, folks. How about a few key points we could wrap up this episode and let people know what they should take away?
All right. Well, I'm going to give one quick case example because I wanted to jump in there. Another one, which is the I mentioned it before, which is Chinook is a donor of 3MH and 4MMP. Okay, so those are the two super tropical and super citrusy drivers. Or 3MHA is the citrusy driver, excuse me. But I would never describe Chinook as a citrusy hop.
Okay,
it's real kind of piney and sometimes kind of fruity, but mostly just big, bold, and dank.
Yeah, I think people would agree.
In concert with Laurel, Super High Linalool, Sabru, an even match of Linalool and Geraniol, and Brewer's Gold, which is really high Geraniol, you should end up with a crazy citrus bomb.
Really?
So, you know, I would encourage people to try this.
Yeah.
It should be pretty cool.
Homebrewers out there, I want you to give this a shot, and then maybe you can send us your beer. I'd be interested to try it.
Yeah. I mean, and you opened the floodgates, dude.
Well, I'll tell you at the end of the show, too, but you can email me at hopsandbrewschool@thebrewingnetwork.com. And if you've done this exact experiment, we'll maybe pick a couple.
Ah, okay. And so just as a quick note, again, Nerol and Citronellol are not found in significant quantities in hops on their own usually, but they're really important in the final beer, and that's the thing that some will evolve from some of these precursor compounds, these precursor molecules. And with the high amounts of these compounds and thiols, you should have a pretty dang citrusy beer.
All right.
And going back through the notes that what we said about the other compounds, you can do the same thing for tropical.
All right. So here we go. Understand what drives aromatics in hops. We're helping you do that here today, and I'll put some of these notes in our show notes so you can go back and check it out. Understand which hops have those in high proportion and in what absolute levels they have.
Yep.
Which, again, we'll give you a little list. And you can also go to yakimachief.com and look these things up, too, get information about different hops. We'll try to fill out more and more information here on the show as we can. And then as Nick was just suggesting, practice combining the hops that have these in good proportion to create the profile you want. And, of course, keeping in mind, like we've been talking about, some things might change. Mm-hmm. Some things might get lifted in good ways. Some not so much.
Yeah, and that's be wary of adding too high of a ratio of hops that contain the aromatics that you don't want.
Okay.
To the combo, if you're adding a lifter. Like if there's something that you're not super, super hot on, don't add too much of that, because even though it might lift everything else up, it's going to add that to your beer.
Got it.
And the other compounds in the other hops might interact with that to create something nasty or something beautiful. So basically play.
Yeah.
But keep notes. So basically, balance in all things hopheads, except taking data. Rigorous data collection and analysis. Come on, guys. You got to take notes.
It's going to be a theme for this podcast, I can tell. Always collect data and a lot of it.
Dang straight.
All right. Well, I want to thank Pat and Tommy for coming down from Yakima to join these couple shows we did. I appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, it was great.
You had a task ahead of you to teach me something, and I think you did.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
I mean, if I had to tell you how many times I had to take chemistry in high school just to graduate, you'd be shocked. So I appreciate all the help.
No problem.
Well, we've got a lot more coming up in future episodes, so stay with us, and thanks for joining us here on the Hop and Brew School podcast. Nick, you're doing a great job. I'm having fun, man.
Thank you. It's quite an honor to be here after 15 years
of listening.
Yeah, well, yeah, I missed a couple of years there, here and there, but in general, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
you made my drives much better.
I appreciate that. Glad we could do it, and I'm happy to be working with you. Once, like I said, you can email us at hopandbrewschool@thebrewingnetwork.com. Send your feedback, questions, show ideas. We'll take it all there. Go to YakimaChief.com to visit Yakima Chief Hops, and they've got different tools that you can use to look up your lots, and they've got an online marketplace coming up soon, so you might want to go enter your email address there so you can get updates on that and be the first to know of when you can order hops direct. Find this podcast on iTunes and Google Play. Tell all your friends about it if they're also hop heads. You can also check it all out on thebrewingnetwork.com where we put the show notes. And heck, I might even put a picture of Nick up there one of these days.
Oh, God.
Let's see what you're dealing with here.
Oh, jeez. You getting me one pick of my nose?
All right, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Hop and Brew. It's a long show, Nick. I was so close to a perfect ending. We'll see you next time on the Hop and Brew School podcast.